So I want to start today with a question that maybe you could ask yourself. And the question is very simply put this: who are you? Who are you? Who am I? And I'm sure there are a whole bunch of things that might come to mind when you ask yourself that question. So you might say, well, I'm a father or I'm a mother, a son or a daughter, a brother or a sister. Or you might say, I'm an engineer or a doctor, I'm a policeman, I'm a stay-at-home mom or dad. Or maybe you might say, I'm a musician, I'm a rock climber, I'm a long-distance runner. Maybe you might say, I'm a coffee person, or I'm a tea person. I'm a Starbucks person, or I'm a Pete's person. Maybe you say, I'm Asian, or I'm Indian, or I'm Caucasian, or I'm Hispanic. All of these things say something about who you are, but do any of these things really get at the essence of who you are? Amidst all the things that may be true about you, what is the truest thing about you? What is the truest thing about you? And today we're going to start a new series, which is called Worth It. It's going to be a 6-week series, and this is really a series about who we are. It's about our identity, and it's about the basis of our value and of our worth as human beings. And as we explore this, we're going to look at God's word, and we're going to ask the questions like, what does God say is the truest thing about me? What does he say about what I'm really worth? Now, some of you might be wondering, well, why does this even really matter? Maybe you're one of those folks who think that if you just keep peeling back the onion, you're going to be left with nothing in the end. But I would say these are very important questions. If one of the most important parts of your identity has ever changed, you know exactly what I'm saying. Maybe you had a job you loved. I mean, you felt like you were doing something that really mattered, something that you were really good at. Or maybe you were in a relationship. You've always dreamed of having a relationship like that. You felt loved. You felt connected like never before. Or maybe you finally realized the financial dreams that you always worked so hard for and hoped for, but then something happened and it was gone. Stuff happens, right? Your employer decides out of the blue to downsize and you're let go. That relationship that meant so much goes south. The stock market or the housing market crashes. And all of a sudden, who you are is no longer who you thought you were. Who are you then? Who are you then? Years ago, I was working as a youth pastor at a church over in Pleasanton. I loved my job, man. I felt like I was just doing what I was created to do, having an impact, and just loving what I was doing. But I also realized that I had to finish seminary. So I resigned from my job, and I moved my wife and 4-year-old daughter to Denver, Colorado. And I became a full-time student. But to help make ends meet for us, I also worked as a waiter in a restaurant. So all of a sudden, I was no longer a pastor. I was a 30-year-old student and waiter in a restaurant. And honestly, it was really, really hard for me. And I had to go through a process of kind of redefining my identity, redefining my sense of worth. These questions of identity matter because how we view ourselves impacts the way we live and the way we feel in our lives. Eckhart Tolle wrote, you find peace not by rearranging the circumstances of your life, but by realizing who you are at the deepest level. And I would add, not only do you find peace, but you find purpose, you find meaning, you find identity. Everything we do in life has a sense behind it of our identity, of how we view ourselves. How we view ourselves matters in terms of how we live our lives. And so today what I want us to do is look at a portion of the book of Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes is a book found right after the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament. And the book of Ecclesiastes is actually considered wisdom literature. There are three books in the Old Testament that are technically called wisdom literature, and those are Ecclesiastes, Job, and Proverbs. And what these books do is they sort of reveal the collected wisdom of generations of God's people. And they invite us to consider what it means to live wisely and what it means to live foolishly. And Ecclesiastes, I think, is a good place for us to start in this series, because what it does in chapters 1 and 2 especially is it chronicles a man's search for meaning, significance, and identity. And so if you have a Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We'll have the words up on the screen. But I just want you to see how he opens up this book. In verse 1 of chapter 1, it says, "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless." And what a great introduction, huh? Wow. But notice he identifies himself as the son of David and the king of Israel. And for this reason, many believe that the author of this book was a man named Solomon, who was in fact David's son, King David's son. And not only that, he was king of Israel. He was one of David's sons, but he was the one who succeeded David on the throne. Now, there are some other scholars who believe that it wasn't Solomon, but it was simply someone writing in Solomon's name. Notice he also calls himself the teacher. And this is what I'll call him throughout this message, the teacher. And he gives his thesis for the whole book right off the bat. He says, "Meaningless, meaningless, everything is utterly meaningless." And what he's saying is that many of the ways he sought to find meaning and significance in his life were meaningless, were worthless, were vanity. Ultimately, they did not satisfy. They ended up being a dead-end street for him. And he goes on, and throughout chapters 1 and 2, he reflects on some of the ways that he sought to find his worth and identity and meaning in life that ended up in futility. And the first one was what I would call a search for knowledge. So if you get your sense of identity and worth by attaining knowledge, then the truest thing about you is you are what you know. You are what you know. So listen to what he says about this in verse 13 of chapter 1. He says, "I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, 'Look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge.' And then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief." So notice that this quest that he is on for knowledge is not just a little hobby for the teacher. This was an all-consuming passion. And it would have to be because his subject is so comprehensive. I mean, look what he says. He says, "Listen, I want to study and explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens." Gosh, could you be a little more ambitious? He didn't leave anything out in his quest for knowledge. He turned over every rock to see what was there. And the teacher also, by the way, is far from humble. He wants us to know how qualified he is to comment on this. He says, "I've increased in wisdom more than anyone else before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge." So not a real humble guy. But this is one of the roads that people take to find meaning today. Have you heard it? Knowledge is power. Knowledge is power, we're told. Did you know the first time that phrase was recorded was in a 10th century book, quoting a guy named Imam Ali, who said this: "Knowledge is power, and it can command obedience. A man of knowledge during his lifetime can make people obey and follow him, and he's praised and venerated after his death. Remember that knowledge is a ruler and wealth its subject. We still believe that. We see this thinking today. We have to get an advanced degree. We have to read more books. We need to take that online course. We have to do whatever we can do to increase our knowledge, to get ahead. And if that means spending $300,000 on a college degree, by all means. So what did he discover? He's very honest about some of his conclusions here in his quest for knowledge. He says, listen, it's a heavy burden God has laid on people. He's talking about the frustration of trying to make sense out of life. When you think about it, we humans are stuck with an unfortunate predicament. On the one hand, God placed this desire in our hearts to make sense out of our world. We crave some kind of coherence, some kind of order, but we can never quite figure it all out. We never get that last word to complete the crossword puzzle of life. Have you ever felt like that? How do you make sense out of some guy who walks into his workplace and out of the blue kills as many people as possible and then takes a gun and shoots himself in the head? I mean, what do you do with that? This is why the teacher twice says it's like chasing after the wind. In other words, it's an impossible task. T.S. Eliot once said, all of our knowledge brings us nearer to our own ignorance. And the teacher's frustration is expressed this way. He says, what is crooked can't be straightened, and what is lacking can't be counted. And what he's saying here is that fundamentally, something is wrong with this world. It's crooked. It's like trying to count what's not there. And in essence, he's saying, with all our knowledge, we really can't change anything. Modern technology creates new opportunities, but we ruin the environment in the process. Law enforcement tries to limit the availability of drugs, but in doing so, they make the prices and the profits go up and the dealers get richer. Prisons breed crime instead of reducing it. And so the teacher is forced to conclude. He says, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Now, as followers of Christ, we know that we value wisdom and knowledge. We do not opt for a mindless faith. We love God not just with our hearts and with our strength and with our soul. We love God with our minds as well. But when we believe that we are what we know, we will end up empty-handed and full of despair. If you know anything about some of the greatest intellects the world has ever known, some of the great philosophers, you know how true this is. Men like Nietzsche and Hemingway were gloomy men, very gloomy men. In fact, one of the great philosophers of all time, the existentialist philosopher John Paul Sartre, he said this, the meaningless absurdity of life is the only incontestable knowledge available to man. Wow, there's a lot of hope in that. And so when we come to this conclusion, it settles like dust on all of our so-called knowledge. So to make wisdom and knowledge the truest thing about you is a dead-end street. And I know we have some very smart people in this church, and you've worked really hard to attain the knowledge that you have, and that's not a bad thing. But it's not a worthy foundation for your worth and your identity. We're more than just what we know. And this discovery propels the teacher down a different road. And you know, if we really can't know anything for sure, then we may as well just have as much fun as we can, right? As one famous screenwriter, I won't mention his name, said, he said, what I want is a good time. The rest is propaganda. So the teacher, he turns down a different path now. And this is a path that defines our identity by this, you are what you enjoy or experience. You are what you enjoy or experience. Look what he says in chapter 2, starting in verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. So this is a familiar path today, right? I mean, there are lots of people today, in our world today, especially in America, and especially right here in the Bay Area, who define themselves in terms of having fun, experiencing pleasure in one form or another, maybe seeking for thrills or seeking to fulfill that bucket list that you might have. Think about it. I mean, browse through a few magazines. What are they really selling you? They're not selling you a car. They're selling you the good life. They're not selling you good wine, but the exciting life portrayed by all the beautiful people in the ad. They don't show you the frustration of the guy in the car when he loses his job and the company calls in the lease. They don't show you the loneliness and despair of the young woman in the ad who wakes up with some guy sleeping in her bed and she's not even sure what happened the night before. They don't show you that. So the teacher here, really what he does is he takes us to a party. He says, come on, let's go. There's laughter. The wine is flowing freely. And he kind of says to himself, self, why not have a good time? You deserve it. You've been pushing hard. Take a break. Have some fun. Life is so short. His intention is not just to get wasted on booze, but he sees this as kind of an experiment. He says he's still being guided by wisdom. It's like he's thinking, you know, I need to experiment with these things. Maybe I can discover the secret of life through just letting go, just having a good time. As a philosophy of life, we call this hedonism, which says that the pursuit of pleasure is the primary goal of life. But you know what? You can only party so much. Pretty soon you realize when you laugh at everything, nothing's funny. And whatever thrill you're seeking has diminishing returns, and you need more and more and more just to stay entertained. I love how Solomon wrote it in Proverbs. He said, even in laughter, the heart may ache, and rejoicing may end in grief. So you are more than what you enjoy. You are more than what you experience. So you head down another path. This one is a far more productive path. It's not you are what you enjoy, but you are what you do. You are what you do. Now here on the San Francisco Peninsula, with Silicon Valley just down the road, we're very, very good at this. Because isn't it true that so often we define ourselves by what we do, by our careers? So our job is about way more than just making money, although that's part of it. It's about who we are. It's about our identity. Now, honestly, that's nothing new. I mean, think about it. Think about some of the last names we have right here in this church. I mean, think about names like Smith, Baker, Miller, Archer, Brewster. What do you think those people did for a living way back when? Right? So what would your last name be if it were defined by your profession? I just got home this week from a couple of weeks of vacation, and just to be honest for you, especially at first, sometimes like vacation is hard for me. I know you're not feeling sorry for me, but sometimes it is. Here's why. Because I'm not doing what I normally do to find my identity and worth. Right? So, and these days, honestly, I think about that a lot because like this week, I know it's hard to believe, but I'm going to turn 63. And I've been a pastor for almost 40 years. So who am I? Am I Mark Mitchell or am I Mark Pastor? Who am I? And what will happen to me and my sense of worth and my sense of identity and my sense of significance when I'm no longer a pastor? So listen to what the teacher says, what he discovered about this you are what you do mentality. Verse 4 of chapter 2. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So he goes on and on about all these things he did, right? He builds houses, plants vineyards, makes gardens and parks and fruit trees. He's got ponds and he learns how to irrigate forests for growing trees. And I can just imagine that there's probably some kind of rationalization for this. You know, maybe I can do some public good here. I mean, everyone will enjoy the parks and the gardens and the forests, and someday I'll even make an endowment on it. But when he's brutally honest, he admits he really did this all for himself. Notice he says, I built houses for who? For myself. For myself. So he's all about me, myself, and I. And he concludes, in the end, this is all meaningless at well. Don't get me wrong. I think it's important to say here that work, doing things, is a good thing. It's part of being made in the image of God. God was a worker. God created. We create. We work. So work is a good thing. God created work. God gave us talents and he gave us interests so we can provide for our families and so we can make the world a better place. But here's the deal. We've elevated a true thing about us to the truest thing about us. To the truest thing about us. And that's a problem. You're more than what you do. Because sooner or later, we can't do what we used to do. It's going to happen to all of us. Sooner or later, we can't do what we used to do. Who are we then? What are we worth then? And so this naturally leads to one more dead-end street in this search for identity and worth. And this is what I would call, you are what you have. You are what you have. Verse 7, he says, I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. So, what does he have? He has slaves. He has livestock. He has silver and gold. He has the king's tribute from conquered lands. He even has his own entertainment center. How contemporary is this? I mean, honestly, I'm still trying to figure out how to stream music. He didn't have to stream music. He had live singers. That's what he says. I have male and female singers. He also has a harem so he can enjoy what he calls the delights of the hearts of man. Now, of course, today, this you are what you have mentality looks a little bit different. So it might be the car you drive. It might be the jewelry or the clothes that you wear. It might be the neighborhood that you live in, your zip code, if you will. I mean, we know we live in one of the hardest, most expensive places in the world to buy a home. So many of us define ourselves by whether we rent or own where we live. When we say you are what you have, we're really talking about two things, consumerism and materialism. Consumerism is the cultural force that encourages the creation of our identity based on the consumption of stuff. Materialism reinforces that by convincing us that our value is equal to the value of what we own. Now, how does this you are what you have thinking impact us? I think in three ways. First of all, it breeds selfishness. Notice again in verse 8, he says, I amassed silver and gold for myself. For who? For myself. So building our identity on the foundation of what we have will often cause us to be more and more inward focused on ourselves. Second, it breeds insecurity. If you are what you have, you will always be worrying about losing what you have, and your focus will be on keeping it safe. And third, it breeds pride. I love how he says in verse 9, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. What a statement. His father was King David. He said, I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. But we would never say that. We're far more subtle about it. But our pride in what we have often leaks through. And it's not like we're getting any better or any wiser about this in our society today. I checked out a recent study that compared college freshmen back in 1969 to college freshmen today. So in 1969, apparently, 42% of all college freshmen said they went to college so they could be better off financially later on in life. 42%, 1969. Today, in a study of nearly 220,000 college freshmen, 78% said material prosperity was their primary goal. Isn't that interesting? Well, after this teacher has gone all through these different paths, seeking meaning, seeking significance, seeking worth, I can kind of just imagine that one day when the singers had the day off, when it was quiet around the palace, maybe he took a walk in the early dusk of evening, and he says in verse 11, and this kind of concludes what he came up with, in verse 11 he says, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." Somewhere along the line, he learned that you are what you know, and you are what you enjoy, and you are what you do, and you are what you have, is chasing after the wind. There's nothing to say of any one of those things that cannot be taken away from you. There's nothing we can know or experience or do or have that can supply a sure foundation for our worth and our identity. I recall so well a conversation I had with one of the pitchers for the San Francisco Giants when I served as their chaplain. This was a young man, you would all know him, but this was a young man who he had it all. He had wealth, he had fame, he had 3 World Series rings, he had a wonderful, beautiful family, he had it all. But his career was coming to an end, and he knew it. And he was struggling with that. Who am I? And he came up to me after one of our chapels, and he basically said this, "Listen, I've always found my worth and my identity in being a baseball player. Is it possible for me to change? Is it possible for me to actually find that now in God? Can God actually be the source of my worth and my identity?" Well, you'll be glad to know the writer of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, would answer all of those questions in the affirmative. Because at the very end of chapter 2, it's kind of like he comes out of the fog, and it's like he gets a ray of light, and he shares some important truth with us. Listen to what he says, starting in verse 24 of chapter 2. He says, "A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Now, at first, it almost sounds like he's returning to a hedonistic philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, but he's not. Notice now, God is very much in the equation of what he says. And I want you to notice a couple of profound things he says about God that will help us in our search for meaning and significance and identity. First, he says, true satisfaction, true, we might call it inner peace today, is found from God. It is a gift of God. So by themselves, what you know or what you enjoy or what you do or what you have are meaningless. These are foundations upon which our identity will crumble. But if you understand all of these things in their rightful place coming from the hand of God, and even your ability to enjoy them comes from the hand of God, then you will be able to see these things, now listen to me, are part of who you are. They're part of who you are, but they are not the truest thing about you. They're not the truest thing about you. It's God's desire that all the good things of life should contribute to our enjoyment and our meaning and our significance. But if we understand that meaning and significance don't come from what we have or do or know or enjoy, only then. It comes from God. And it comes from receiving the simple pleasures of life as a gift from God's hand. Now, second, he says in these verses that I just read that this gift is given to those who please God. It's given to those who please God. He says, to the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. You see, if you think you can find wisdom, knowledge, and happiness, and I would add a sense of identity and worth apart from being in a right relationship with God, pleasing God, then you will come up empty-handed in the end. These gifts only come to those who please God. I don't know, the question I want to ask, well, who pleases God? Who really pleases God? Notice he mentions the sinner in this context as well, who ironically, he says, in the end, hands everything over to the one who pleases God. Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? But we're all sinners, right? God says in his word very clearly over and over again that we all fall short of pleasing God. No matter how hard we try, no matter how good we are, we all fall short. And so this is where what we call the gospel, the good news, comes in. You see, because the gospel says that God loves us in our sin and in our brokenness. The gospel says he loves us so much he sent his only son. The gospel says that we become pleasing to God through faith in him, who not only died for us, but was raised up for us. And so we put our trust in Jesus, and he cleanses us from our sin, and he begins to work within us so that we actually become people who please him in all that we do. And so our worth fundamentally comes from listening to that voice that matters most, the voice of God who says, you are worth it. You're worth my son. You're worth my son. You please me not because you're so good, but just because I say so and just because you're mine. The truest thing about you is that you are a beloved child of God. Leo Tolstoy, as you probably know, is one of the great novelists, Russian novelists of all time. I'm sure that we all have read War and Peace, right? Yeah, nice try. But he wrote War and Peace. He also wrote a book in 1879 called A Confession. And it tells the story of his own search for meaning, his own search for identity, his own search for worth and purpose in life. And apparently, Tolstoy had grown up with Christianity, but he rejected Christianity even as a child. And when he finally left the university, his primary goal was to seek pleasure. You are what you enjoy. You are what you experience. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, he drank heavily. He lived promiscuously. He gambled frequently. His ambition was to become wealthy and famous. And he did. But nothing satisfied him. And then in 1862, he married a beautiful, loving wife. They had 13 children together. He was surrounded by what appeared to be complete happiness. Everything was in place. He had it all. And yet one question just continually haunted Tolstoy to the verge of suicide, and it was this: is there any meaning in my life which will not be annihilated by the inevitability of death, which awaits me? He searched for answers in science, in philosophy, And as he discovered, especially the Russian sort of nobility and the wealthy people that he was around, he felt that they were not facing up to the big questions of life. Like, where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? And eventually, as he began to get to know the peasant people of Russia, he found that these questions could actually be answered in the Christian faith. And he came to realize that it was only the gospel of Jesus Christ that would give him the answer to those questions. And folks, 150 years later, nothing has changed. In the gospel, the voice that matters most says, "You are my beloved child. I created you. I ransomed you. And I want to spend eternity with you." And that is the truest thing about you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for reminding us who we are and that we are beloved of God. Forgive us, Father, for so often seeking our meaning and our purpose and our identity in what we have and what we do and what we enjoy, all these things. Father, we confess before you how broken we are and how often we look to these things to prop us up, to give us a sense of worth and identity. Father, help us as your children, as your people, as your much-loved children, to begin more and more each day to rehearse in our minds and our hearts that we are beloved children of God, worthy of your Son. We ask this in his name. Amen.